Absolute. Pre-Dead Boys. It is the podcast about the I'm sorry. Let me roll that back. That was incorrect. Welcome to the Pre-Dead Boys. It is the award-winning podcast about the history and culture of death and decomposition. My name is Dorian. With me, as always, is Max. How you doing, Max?
Doing good. Better now that you did the intro correctly.
Correctly. I think I might have goofed it and missed the award-winning bit the past couple episodes. So let's get the record straight. We're still an award-winning podcast, and we do plan to continue to be an award-winning podcast.
I'm really putting myself on blast for, like, not listening to the show after we finish it.
You're spacing out.
Yeah.
No, that's cool. That's kind of a narcissistic thing to do, to listen to your own podcast after you record it. Like, that's what I do.
It's like having a kid and looking at your kid after you have a kid.
It's the same thing. Don't look at your kid, you asshole. What are you thinking?
Get that out of there.
What is up with you, man? How's life?
Feeling good. Now I'm recovering from the Groundhog Day marathon I did recently.
I was wondering if you would want to talk about that, because I know that, that was a bit of a traumatic experience for you last year.
It was difficult. Yeah, there's a local theater here in Columbus that is great, Gateway Film Center, and you go in, where we won an award.
That's where we became an award-winning podcast.
But you go in and you watch the movie Groundhog Day for 24 hours straight.
So what is that, 12 times?
12 times, yep. And it's like a 101-minute movie. So you get a 20-minute break after every showing, and then you're right back in there.
Yeah. So why do you do this?
You get a year of free movie tickets.
A year of free movie tickets?
Yeah.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah, it's
I didn't know that part.
Yeah, what'd you think? I was just going in there for fun?
Yeah, you do weird shit all the time just because it's a weird experience. And I that's what I thought was the case with you. You just, this will be strange, and then you just keep doing it and putting yourself through this pain.
The humiliating thing was that, so I started a new job.
Yes.
And my manager is very sweet and is trying to figure out things about me, I think.
Yeah.
You know? And
get to know you.
Yeah. And so she came in and was like, oh, what'd you do this weekend? And I explained that I had done that. And she was like, oh, you must be a big movie guy then. And then I had to confront, like, not really. I was like, it'll be a stretch. It'll get me to the theater, having all these free tickets.
Okay. Yeah. That is interesting. What would you say it is? Is it just the appeal of the deal is like hard for you to resist?
Yeah, I like going to movies. I just don't do it enough.
Yeah, that's a great reason to go. How much was it?
$20.
$20?
$20.
$20 and 24 hours of your life that you can never get back?
Yeah, for like, hundreds of dollars in free tickets. So
that is a really good, I might sign up for that next year.
No, don't do it. I'm not going to do it again. I don't know, because you can't be on your phone and they don't really let you sleep. So
you can't be on your phone?
No.
Why?
No screens.
No screens?
No.
So you just have to sit in the theater. Are you allowed out of the theater?
You can, like, go to the bathroom.
That's it?
But you have to get, like, you have, like, a lanyard, and you have to get it punched.
To go to the bathroom?
No, at the end of every showing, you have to get your lanyard punched. So you have to be in line at the theater every time the movie ends.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
This sounds like an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, I switched on you, huh?
Yeah. Let us never speak of this god-awful marathon again.
Well, we will speak about it again, because this year it was actually on Groundhog Day.
Yes.
Which is very fun.
Yeah. Watch Groundhog Day a bunch of times on Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
There you go.
So they announced it, like, during the it starts at 2 p.m. on Saturday and goes till 2 p.m. on Sunday. So it, during like the 8th, 9th showing, they come in and they go, hey, guess what? The groundhog came out in like real life and he didn't see a shadow.
Yay.
So, which means it's like spring is coming early.
Yeah.
I love spring a lot.
I do too.
You know, I like when it gets warm and I like when there's like a nice rain. I like rain.
Mm-hmm.
I like laying in the nice green grass.
In the rain?
In the rain, sometimes.
You like to lay down in the rain?
Yeah. And okay. Just lay down in the grass and just kind of let your body decompose.
Yeah. What, like, you mean like relax or do you mean literally
decaying? Just start decomposing and decaying.
Okay. You like to just lay down and die in the grass.
Yeah. Specifically decomposing, but they don't really let you do that in a lot of places.
Max, I'm beginning to worry about you.
But it got me thinking about body farms.
I am so fucking excited. I have been itching to talk about body farms, to learn more about body farms for so long. I'm so excited for this episode.
They're very fun. I mean, a lot of people have said, oh, you should do body farms. And I'm not going to thank any of them because I didn't write any of them down. So if you, you suggested you this, thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much.
But yeah, it's our 2 year.
2 years.
2 year anniversary.
Yeah, as of Valentine's Day.
Yeah. So I figured this would be a fun thing to do for our anniversary.
Aw.
Big one.
We're going to hold hands and kiss the rest of this episode.
Yeah, so I figured what we could get into now is... Why are you laughing? Is my technique bad? What? Stop.
That's really good Foley work,
so
man.
Conscious.
I don't know how that's going to play with people listening to this.
Just kiss noises.
We're going to have a lot of friends who are like, are you guys okay?
Just kissing.
You talked about laying down and decomposing, and then you just made out for an episode of the show.
We're trying to tighten these intros up, so.
Yes.
So I guess with that out of the way, let's crack into our special 2 year birthday topic with the Pre-Dead Boys Crack Into the Topic moment, brought to you by the king, the one, the only, Polar. Good simultaneous.
We're getting good at this shit. If I do say so myself.
What's that Malcolm Gladwell thing? It takes you 2 years of practicing something every other week to become an expert at it.
I think that's exactly it.
Body farms.
Body farms.
This one's going to be fun. I'm very excited about this. We're going to be pulling a lot from Wikipedia, a really good Atlantic article by Monica Raymond, and a few other places that I'll nod to as we go. So I know you know what these are, but can you give us a bird's eye view of what they are real quick?
A body farm is a research facility where decomposition can be studied in a variety of settings. By placing the bodies outside to face the elements, researchers are able to get a better understanding of the decomposition process. The name itself comes from a 1995 crime novel by Patricia Cornwell titled The Body Farm. Body farms refer to themselves using the much more academic-sounding moniker of anthropological research facilities. In other words, ARFs.
ARF, ARF.
Where my Knocked Loose fans at.
So we will probably use the shorthand of body farms throughout this episode.
You don't want to call them ARFs?
Anthropological research facilities.
That's a mouthful.
Body farm is way cooler. ARF is... making a dog noise.
It's very silly.
So, I know what you might be thinking, but contrary... I'm touching your knee.
I didn't expect that. I was like, ah!
Contrary to what the name sounds like, a body farm is not where babies come from. It's not where you go to pick up a baby.
Yeah.
It's not where babies are grown.
Okay. It's not like that scene in The Matrix. Spoiler warning.
I've never seen The Matrix.
You've never seen The Matrix? I've
never seen The Matrix.
I think it's still on Netflix. It's worth watching. It's very good. First one. Don't watch the other two.
Maybe I should, because I recently saw Inception for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it was like, I knew all about Inception when it came out. And then in like the intermittent 8 years, I just forgot a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw it and it was kind of fresh.
Right.
And so I feel like with the Matrix, I can like go into it with a fresh mind now and not be like, oh, look, they're doing the bullet time.
Yeah, I think it holds up. Not in the sense that it's like a movie you can take seriously. It's like somewhat brainy, somewhat 90s cheesy science fiction.
Okay.
Followed by just really fun spectacle action pieces. And yeah, it's just, it's worth watching. It holds up.
All right. I'll track it.
Science fiction hour before we get into the real body farms.
where they grow human bodies.
Yeah.
So body farms are, in fact, where bodies are stashed the opposite after being born, after you die.
Yes.
And they allow forensic researchers to study the process of human decomposition. So currently, there are 7 of these anthropological research facilities in the United States and a couple others throughout the world. Like there's one in the Netherlands, there's one in Australia. They provide a really invaluable service to both forensic investigators and researchers.
That's interesting. I feel like the last time I heard about the number in the United States, it was 3. And that was maybe a couple of years ago. Like, are there new ones opening up? Or do you know if these have been around for a while?
They open up, you know, every couple years.
Okay.
We're going to talk about it kind of towards the end.
Okay.
About some of the issues that arise when they open up.
Sure.
But they do open up. And there it is a, I guess, growing industry.
Yeah. It's a growing need, it seems like.
Yeah. Because people keep killing each other.
People keep dying.
So here's a walkthrough of kind of the research methodology of what they do. And this is from that really good Atlantic article I mentioned earlier.
The forensic anthropologists who perform research at body farms are interested in forensic taphonomy, or the study of what physically happens to a body between death and the time it is recovered. The effect that precipitation, temperature, and humidity have on a decomposing body are important factors that researchers on body farms actively consider. Cold weather generally slows the rate of decomposition, while heat, direct sunlight, and high humidity all accelerate it. A buried body exposed to fewer elements will decompose more slowly than one on the surface, but acidic soil and high soil moisture can work to speed up the process. As an example, the California University of Pennsylvania Body Farm, located in the southwestern corner of Pennsylvania in a humid continental climate, is subject to hot, humid summers, cold, snowy winters, and regular precipitation throughout the year. These climatic conditions, distinct from body farms in Texas, North Carolina, and Tennessee, affect corpses in undocumented ways and provide ample opportunity for new research.
So we can start to see here, like, the ways these places use corpses for research. If you are walking around in the woods and you come across someone who has been murdered, which is bad.
That's bad. We don't recommend that.
One of the first things you need to do is figure out how long the person has been dead for. This helps you build a timeline of when you need to, like, who you need to be interviewing, who should be considered a suspect. Do you need to be looking at people who have disappeared from town 2 months ago and haven't come back?
Right.
But as mentioned, the like decomposition rate of a body can change a lot depending on where the body is dumped. So if you drop a body in like the desert, it's going to decompose significantly differently than a body that gets dropped in like a rainforest.
Right. Different conditions are going to affect it in different ways.
Yeah. A body dropped in a really cold environment may just not decompose at all. That's how you get those like cool mummies.
Yeah.
In, like the Andes Mountains.
Yeah. I was thinking about our Mount Everest episode when we talked about how there are preserved bodies that are literally used as landmarks.
Yeah.
Go back and listen to that if you haven't.
Yeah, that's very cool. And like when you're investigating a murder like this, it's really helpful to have a database of different decomposition patterns a body can take to be able to have the most effective timeline.
Okay, yeah.
You know, like there's always the thing where like, oh, what if a murderer like killed somebody and put him in a freezer for, you know, months and then put him out in the, I don't know, put him in the woods And then that would throw the whole timeline off, you know?
Right.
You want to have a large amount of different cases and scenarios you can look at with this.
Right. A pretty broad, like, collection of information in different situations.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I knew that bodies decayed differently. Because, you know, we've talked about, as you said, Everest. And then there's, like, bodies that you hear about in, like, areas that have a lot of, like, bugs where they'll be gone in, like, a couple days because these bugs just keep coming in.
Right.
But I didn't really know how much this decomposition could vary. So I came across a Vox article by Giselle Ruiz about Dr. William Bass, who founded the first body farm in the United States, which is at the University of Tennessee.
Love this guy. Highly recommend the book Death's Acre if you have not read it. That's his basically autobiography where he talks about opening that first body farm.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's so good. It's so fascinating. He's also just seemed like a really cool guy.
Yeah, he's kind of a weirdo.
Yeah, I love him. Okay, here we go. Bass came up with the idea for body farms around the time he was asked to consult on a local case. The police had noticed that the Civil War era grave of Colonel William Shy had been recently disturbed. They exhumed the coffin to make sure no tampering had occurred, and the corpse inside looked surprisingly fresh. They suspected that someone had recently been murdered and then placed in this old grave in order to cover up the crime. Bass noted the body's still pink flesh and informed police that he indeed believed that the Civil War era corpse had been swapped for a recent body, one dead less than a year. He was wrong. Further analysis of the dead man's teeth and clothes showed that this was indeed William Shy, his body preserved thanks to embalming and a welded iron casket.
Yeah, this is a very goofy story. Does he talk about this in the book?
Yeah, it's one of the first few chapters, but
yeah.
Yeah, it just, that's a great way to seal a body and keep it for a long time.
Yeah, and I mean, this guy was dead like 100 years or something.
Right, yeah, at the time it was roughly 100 years.
And what was the deal? Like, they had a, his skull had been stolen or something? No, it wasn't his head. I don't know.
I think that might have been a different story in the book, but
okay,
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Either way.
I don't prepare these episodes. I'm bad at this.
You're putting me on blast for not having
You do such a good job of, like, preparing for episodes. And if I were thinking, I would have, like, reread and, like, you know, crash course reviewed everything I read. But I didn't think that far ahead, Max.
What this does demonstrate is that decomposition can vary, like, wildly.
Right.
We need to have examples of how different bodies decompose at different rates, so that we don't jump to conclusions like Bass did here. Understandably, we're not knocking him.
Yeah. Well, good on him for having a hypothesis and then doing the work to understand whether or not that hypothesis was true.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, fresh body, definitely a brand new one.
Yeah.
And then leave it at that.
Yeah. He, like, put the work in and was like, oh, maybe this is something we need to do more research into.
Exactly.
But it's not only decomposition that these places study. So a decomposing body creates all kind of environmental effects, and those can be studied as well to establish that forensic timeline.
Hmm.
You know, so it's not just how the body is breaking down, but also the effect that the body has on the environment, like the soil acidity, the grass nearby, and specifically the microbial and insect activity surrounding the body.
Okay. The bugs?
The bugs. So this is where it gets kind of gross.
Yes.
But this is also very cool.
Common insects found in decomposing bodies include green bottle flies, black blowflies, carrion beetles, and flesh flies. Because most insects have an easily observable life cycle, forensic scientists can use insect development to get information from dead bodies as well. In a typical environment, flies will arrive at a dead body, especially one with an open wound, and lay eggs within a few hours. At this point, their maggots hatch within a day or two. From this point on, the age of the insects can be used to determine the length of time the body has been laying out.
I don't like it.
You don't like this?
No. No, like, I had an old coworker who was really into these videos of this doctor who went to India, and he was like a vet, I guess. Vets are still doctors. But he was helping these dogs that would get an infection of the specific fly.
Uh-huh.
And the fly would land on the dog's leg and burrow in and lay eggs. And then there would be maggots in the leg. And I just don't like thinking about maggots in skin. It's...
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I feel at peace with this when it's a dead body. When it's biological material being, you know, processed by nature, it doesn't bother me at all. I'm like, yeah, that's where flies grow. That's part of the circle of life. But when it's a human being, or not even a human being, when it's just any living being with maggots inside of them, I very much hate that. I think I might have told you before, one time I went on a fishing trip in Canada, and I guess the best bait we could use in that specific region was leeches.
Oh.
And that's when I realized, like, any bug or creature whose whole thing is getting inside of skin or sucking blood, just really not a big fan of them. Really hate, I'm a friend to the bugs who are, like, spiders. Love spiders. Not afraid of spiders at all. Like,
praying mantis, beautiful.
Love praying mantis.
Earwigs, big fan.
Don't they burrow in your...
No, what's the helpful one? Silverfish? What are those?
Earwigs are parasites, bud. They're nasty boys, too.
Huh. What's the bug that's like eats all the other bugs and looks like an earwig? There's some helpful bug that does that.
Well, I don't know, but that one's okay by me. Earwigs, no dice. Just any kind of parasitic...
What kind of fish are you catching with leeches?
It was like perch and something else. Oh, I don't know.
Perch are nasty boys, huh?
It's a potent bait. It's like... You know, a step up from worms. Nice, big, juicy leeches. And sometimes they'd be swimming around in the water. Yeah, not a fan.
No. That's, I don't know, that's gross. And we gotta talk about it a little more, though. Because it is genuinely outside of decomposition, and especially if there is a weird decomposition pattern, the development of insects is the best way to time the death of a body.
Interesting.
It's really gnarly, but that's how like sample sizes work, you know? Like if you have a coin and you flip it 5 times, it wouldn't be incredible if it landed on heads all 5 times. That's like a 1 out of 32 chance.
Yeah, okay. Pretty impressive, but not like the craziest thing in the world.
Yeah. But if you do it 1,000 times, it's going to get closer and closer to an average.
Right.
50%. And then it works with, like, a 20-sided dice as well. You know, if you roll that dice 10,000 times, it's going to approach a 5% chance of each number showing up.
Right.
You know?
The only thing with that, though, is that a singular is die, and dice is plural.
All right. There was some D&D talk in the Discord recently, so maybe I am going to get busted
get
on that.
Get roasted. Yeah. I'll roast you now so nobody else can roast you.
It's roast protection.
Be nice to Max. I already roasted him.
And so when you think of like insects, which you can observe in a lab really easily and whose life cycle is relatively short, if you observe thousands of insect life cycles, you can get a really good idea of what the average is going to be.
Right.
And so we know that if we see like green bottle flies, we know, depending on how old they are and how big they are, about how long that bug has been around.
Okay. And they go with an average for the age. They don't just try to look for, like, the oldest bottle fly. Well, I guess that doesn't necessarily... Yeah, that could be the one that laid the eggs in the first place, so...
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
size is more indicative than just, like, any one.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Sorry, answered my own question there.
So, you know, it works pretty well, but this was something actually very cool. Up until recently, scientists didn't realize that sometimes things can happen that can cause the insect life cycle to change. So this is from an article by Renee Ebersole on Undark, which has a lot of really cool articles about science intersecting with culture, and is really recommended.
Undark?
Undark. It's just an online magazine. It's pretty dope.
As decomposition gets rolling, forensic anthropologists mark five physical stages of decay. Fresh, during which a person still looks relatively normal. Bloat, when the body fills with gases. Active decay, when a corpse's soft tissue decomposes. Advanced decay. And finally, dry skeletal remains. During each stage, experts pay close attention to maggots, the worm-like larva of blowflies, wriggling in a corpse's flesh. On a warm, clear day, it can take mere minutes for flies to whiff the slightest decay, like a flashing neon sign announcing a good place to dine and procreate. Body farm researchers are also considering how disease and the pharmaceuticals we take for everything from diabetes and cancer to hypertension and depression might influence the necrobiome and decomposition. Current topics in necrobiome research are investigating whether the bodies of people who suffered from diabetes are more attractive to insects. According to published case studies, amounts of cocaine in a human system can speed up maggots, while barbiturates and sleeping pills can actually do the opposite.
I thought that was really cool.
That is interesting.
Like, if you had diabetes, like, maybe there's just more sugar in your body, and flies like that.
Yeah, you got a sweet body. Yeah. Yum. I love that, like, whatever drugs you're consuming affect the bugs. The maggots are just real jacked up on cocaine.
Yeah. They're, like, doing a lot of, like, weird artwork where they're just, like, sketching really quick.
I don't need sleep.
But it's, like, when you think about it, the amount of cocaine that it takes to affect a human being is a lot compared to the amount of cocaine that it takes to affect a maggot. Oh. So even if you've processed a lot of that cocaine, but especially if you've overdosed on cocaine and died because of that, there's going to be amounts left over.
Right, that makes sense.
And as maggots are burrowing into the warm, soft places in your body, like your I almost said wind hole.
What?
What's it called?
Your windpipe?
What's it called? Oh. Like your respiratory system.
Your wind hole? You wanted to refer to the whole respiratory system as your wind hole?
I was trying to come up with it off the dome there. But your respiratory system is soft and mushy and warm. That's also where cocaine goes.
Yep. Okay. Yeah.
And so maggots like going there, and while they're there, they'll get like their own tiny little
coke
bumps,
den.
Bumps of little maggot cocaine. And it can accelerate their life cycles. It's really interesting, you know?
Oh. Huh. Yeah. Cocaine is a hell of a drug.
So because insects are kind of, they can be unreliable sometimes. It's a cool source, but they can be unreliable. One of the things that body farms are looking into a lot more now is fungus development, because fungus and like the way it grows is kind of unaffected by cocaine and sleeping pills and stuff like that.
Okay. Mushrooms have a high tolerance.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, they're not gonna, they don't care.
They're not wasted.
No, they're just gonna grow. So it's neat, like kind of all these kind of corroborating factors that can go into determining how bodies decompose.
Right.
I feel like this was probably a watch list topic.
Like a watch list topic?
It got me on a list as I was Googling it. Like, what shows up on a decomposing body?
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, just all the weird shit that you're Googling. Honestly, you've probably been on a watch list considering how much shit we've covered on this.
I wonder if there's a way to check that. I don't know.
Yeah, have a friend in the FBI, I guess.
Yeah. If any of our listeners,
hey, if you're a Fed, get in touch.
Yeah. So I don't want to talk about bugs anymore because it's bad and it's gross. And luckily, that's just one part of what body farms do. The big thing that body farms do, the thing that we all know, is that they see how human bodies decompose as a result of various causes of death. If you find, like, a really decomposed body, you might not be able to tell what the person died from. Especially if it was just, like, a couple stab wounds.
Yeah.
But then it's decomposed significantly.
No physical evidence of that stab.
Yeah. Yeah. So because of that, once a farm acquires a body, they do all kinds of things to them.
Oh?
Yeah. And what that lets them do is figure out, like, okay, so this person got hit by a car, but then they decomposed for 6 months. What does that look like at 6 months? You know? It can get kind of wild, and we've got a few examples for you here.
That's gruesome.
Yeah.
The method of decomposition varies depending on the specialty of the body farm. Western Carolina University's body farm is only about 60 square feet and holds at most 10 bodies at a time. Bodies here are usually simply exposed to the elements. However, the Forensic Anthropology Center at the University of Tennessee features buried bodies, unburied bodies, bodies weighed down and placed in water, and bodies locked in the trunks of cars. The Freeman Ranch body farm at Texas State University originally chased away vultures and wild animals, but eventually discovered that allowing vultures to pick at bones revealed valuable information via claw and beak scarring. Other animal evidence can be helpful as well. Rats, for example, come when the bone is still greasy. Rat signatures are fairly easy to recognize because they chew the ends of the bone to get the marrow. Then, after the bone is dry, squirrels come along and gnaw on the bone. So, if a bone has squirrel gnawing, it's been there at least a year. So, squirrels are a time since death indicator, and squirrels tend to gnaw on the bones in the spring, apparently for the calcium for their new litter.
Well, that's cute.
Oh, they chew the bones for the babies.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, if you have rat marks, like rat teeth marks on bones, then you can probably be like, okay, it's probably been here, you know, not a super long time.
Right.
But if you look at the bones and there's a bunch of squirrel tooth marks and it's like fall, you can be like, okay, so this bone, this body was probably out here for a fairly long time. Before last spring, even.
Right.
So then you're kind of looking like a year ago or something like that.
Yeah. That's interesting. You can really... It's crazy how many factors you can use to pinpoint this.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like, I'm just dumb and don't think about it. That there are people out there whose job it is to tell between like rat bite marks and squirrel bite marks. That's cool. I like that.
I would imagine that... well, I don't know. I was going to say that one were bigger than the other, but man, there's like tiny little pet rats, and then there's those creepy big city rats that are like fucking monsters.
Yeah.
Bigger than dogs. This scared the shit out of me, dude.
You don't like them? Those are possums. You're thinking of possums.
No, there's rats that can grow to the size of possums. Have you not seen this?
I've seen them. I've seen them running around.
You're just denying their existence because they creep you out, too.
Because I used to have the cute little rats.
Yeah.
So.
They're very cute pets.
Yeah.
Not great sewer dwelling.
Yeah.
Fucking. Hey, dwell.
Dwell. So other instances I found of things body farms do to bodies, I guess.
Yeah.
Is they will inject them with toxins after death. To mimic cases of poisoning.
Hmm.
They will suspend them from trees to mimic instances of hanging. You want to see how long it's going to take for the vertebrae to start separating there.
Right, and I'm sure blood starts pooling in certain spots that it wouldn't otherwise.
Yep. Yeah, and it's super helpful for researchers to be able to know what that is so that they can start solving crimes like this.
Right.
You know? I did find a couple instances of things happening accidentally.
What kind of accidents are we talking here?
So, there's a body farm at Southern Illinois University.
Mm-hmm.
And they hired a new guy to do some landscaping.
The new guy, huh?
Uh-huh. And body farms are like very well cataloged plots of land. You need to know where things are going to be.
Right.
So they gave the new guy who was mowing the lawn a map. And they were like, you need to mow in these places, but not mow in these other places.
Pretty straightforward.
Pretty straightforward. I guess he wasn't good at reading a map. Because he took a riding lawnmower and mowed over two bodies that were decomposing on site.
Holy shit.
But the researchers took this in stride, and they published a paper titled
Lemonade from Lemons: The Taphonomic Effect of Lawnmowers on Skeletal Remains. That's amazing.
I mean, that, like, I read an interview with the woman who published this paper.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, we were initially really upset, and then we realized someone probably has run over a body with a lawnmower.
Yeah.
And so we decided to research it.
That's amazing. Good on them for being flexible.
And for putting the very funny, like...
Lemonade from lemons. Who says academics can't be humorous?
As I was looking for that too, I was like, so I read about that initially in an article on a website, but the paper wasn't cited. It was just like, some people wrote a paper about a body being run over by a lawnmower.
Why would you not cite that paper?
Furious.
That's the bet. That's literally the funniest citation that I've ever heard.
I had to go digging for it. And so I'm Googling like running over body with lawnmower. Stuff like that.
Sealing the deal for you being on the watch list.
Yeah. And I found a different paper titled Occult Lawnmower Projectile Injury Presenting with Hemoptysis.
What is hemoptysis?
So hemoptysis is like when you're coughing up blood.
And what fuck was this article?
This whole paper was about like a guy was mowing his lawn and like his lawnmower blade knocked something into another guy's, like, it knocked a piece of metal, and the metal went through a guy's, like, rib cage into his lung tissue.
Oh my god.
But I thought it was very funny thinking about occult lawnmower projectiles, and thinking about, like, a lawnmower just shooting out, like, Ouija boards, and, like, pentagrams.
Some kind of possessed lawnmower? That is so wild.
Another like very good thing I found out about body farms is that they have to tailor themselves to be culturally sensitive. So since you can't like redo a body, you can't just reuse it.
What?
You have to be really conscientious about what forensic detectives in your area are looking for. So I was looking into this body farm that opened in the Netherlands. And it talked about how people were worried, like people who live nearby, were worried that the stench from the decaying bodies would drift over to the nearby towns. And they'd be like, oh, it's really stinky. But the people who were running the body farm were like, actually, it won't be like the American ones. We're going to bury a lot of the bodies because, quote,
there isn't a lot of space in the Netherlands to just leave a body around, so most murderers bury their victims.
That was also very good.
I mean, that's pretty insightful.
And I mean, it's like they're in tune with the real life situations that their detectives are having to deal with.
Right. And it's not that these are just frivolous facilities too. They're being realistic with their resources and what they have in their area. That they're very strategic about what they're doing with what they have.
Yeah.
Which is impressive.
Yeah. So like this body farm is going to spend a lot more time like burying a body and then pouring lye over it.
Okay.
Because that's what people do in, it's not what everyone does in Europe. But in a space where there's a lot less space to toss a body, that's an effective way to get rid of them.
You know, everybody in Europe is murdering people. They know their way around a can of lye, right?
All our European listeners are like, oh, well, of course you don't just like. Of course everyone buries the body.
Everyone in England's like, well, yeah, duh, when I murdered people.
It is wild, because the converse of this is just stating, like, the Americans, they have all this space, so when someone gets murdered, they just, like, throw them out the side of the car. It's like that old commercial where, like, the Native American turns back and, like, sheds a single tear.
Because you threw your body out the window.
Yeah. We're just littering over here.
Sadly, you're not wrong.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good summation of what we're about here.
Got a lot of woods. But, you know, like you mentioned, though, these places aren't horror shows. They are very aware of what they're doing. They are highly controlled, very regulated, and they're areas where people are furthering forensic science. Actually, honestly, I had a kind of a tough time looking into some of this stuff, because a lot of these organizations are very quiet about what they do. Like, they don't have listed street addresses, because I tried to, like, Google map some things, and that's very tough.
Yeah.
A lot of them won't let you tour, because, you know, it's like a privacy concern. You don't want people just walking around and seeing your dead relatives' bodies decomposing.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense, too, with the kind of boom in true crime interest, and, like, a bunch of horror fan nut jobs like me are, you know, I hear all of this stuff, and I'm like, when are we going? When are we going to a body farm? I want to go. I want to poke dead bodies. And it's like, it makes total sense. And you're like, eh, slow your roll. Like, this is not an entertainment facility. This isn't something meant for, like, people to just come and enjoy. It's not supposed to be a spectacle.
Yeah. A scientist isn't going to let you, like, walk into their lab and be like, look at that petri dish, and, like, poke it, you know?
Right.
There's really only one way to get into a body farm. Work there.
Oh, so I thought you were going to say die.
No, you gotta work there.
Yeah.
No, you can die too. Body farms rely almost entirely on people who donate their bodies to science. And, like, when you hear, have you read Stiff by Mary Roach?
I have not. I want to.
Great book, awesome read. And one of the things that she points out in that book is that it's actually a little tougher to donate your body to science than you might think. You know, like, when you think of donating your body to science or medicine, you're like, oh, well, they're going to put me on a table at, like, a university, and all the med students are going to dissect me, you know? But when you're teaching students, especially young students, you want the body to be normal.
Right.
You know? So, like, if you've got, like, implants, or have done a lot of medical work, or... A lot of hospitals won't take a body if it's overweight, because that can, like, affect how they store the body. It's kind of tough. It's actually a little tough to get your body put in, like, a medical hospital.
Well, now I've got new fitness goals. It's to stay in shape. Stay in body donating shape.
You really want to get, like, into OSU's morgue?
This body's too shredded. We cannot accept this. He's too strong.
Body farms don't care, though. They are very body positive. They're very nice.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. They want bodies of all shapes, sizes, and variations, because everyone's body is going to decay differently. Like, they want to cast as wide of a net as possible, because all kinds of people get murdered, and they want to be able to expand the knowledge base as much as possible.
Right.
You know?
Huh.
Like, they would want both of our bodies, because your muscular lithe frame...
You gotta stop telling people that I'm muscular.
...is gonna decay differently than my, like, soft, doughy scholar's body.
It's not...
I wanna talk more about your muscular frame. Just making more kissing noises. Valentine's Day, baby.
God.
Our partners are both mad at us.
Yeah. Sorry, Sab.
Sorry, Katrina. This is very cool. The University of Tennessee Body Farm has over 2,000 donors on file, which means someone has signed up to donate their body after they die. And it means they get about 100 bodies a year.
All right.
And another nice thing about body farms, because we rail on, like, how much it costs to have a funeral.
Yeah.
If you are within a couple hundred miles, usually 150 to 250 miles, Most body farms will do free pickup.
Wow, okay.
Because you are furthering what they want to do, you know?
Right.
You are providing a service. You are giving them a gift. They will come out and pick up your body.
Awesome. So if you are not particular for like an open casket ceremony, you can just do whatever celebration of life party or celebration that you want to do. And that is the only cost that you would incur.
Yep. Yeah, it's awesome. I think it's definitely a route that people should consider if you want to donate your body to science. But unfortunately, not everybody is as cool about body farms as we are.
We got some haters.
All right. So body farms naturally get a good deal of pushback.
Sure.
When they open. I found a paper by Kimberly Dotson. It made me think of Jurassic Park, which is very funny.
Is that the name of the...
When Wayne Knight goes, Dotson! We got Dotson here!
Oh.
He's like, see, nobody cares.
Oh, is that...
He's the guy...
I didn't know if you were referring to Laura Dern's character or like... I don't remember any of the
characters.
No,
I'm really like busting myself on how much I watched Jurassic Park. no, so Dotson is the guy who gives Wayne Knight the can of Barbasol.
Oh, okay.
And then Wayne Knight sprays the Barbasol into his hand and wipes it on the pie.
Yeah.
That some guy's about to eat.
Yeah. Man, you... See, you are a film guy.
I'm a film buff. I'm a film buff.
For one film.
Yeah. So this paper is from the Salem Press Encyclopedia of Science, and it talks about some instances, some issues, that anthropological research farms have run into upon opening.
Although the research conducted at body farms has undoubtedly contributed a great deal to the field of forensic anthropology, some people are disturbed by the idea of such facilities in their neighborhoods. Residents who live near proposed sites often protest the opening of these facilities for a variety of reasons, including fears that insects will be attracted to the area, or that scavenging animals will carry off body parts, perhaps dropping them in residents' backyards. When Texas State University proposed placing its body farm about 2 miles from the San Marcos Outlet Mall, one of the biggest tourist attractions in the area, local government officials objected, saying that the mall's businesses would likely be hurt by their proximity to such a facility. The University of Tennessee's body farm was subject to a similar opposition in its early days. Members of a local healthcare advocacy group called Solutions to Issues of Concern to Knoxvillians, aka SICK, protested at the research facility, holding up signs proclaiming, quote, "This makes us sick." A number of local residents also complained about the odor emitted from the body farm. The primary point of contention, however, was that the facility was not completely fenced in, and some people could see the decaying bodies from their homes. The university solved this problem by agreeing to install a privacy fence.
This is a good example of a time when both parties are in the wrong. Like, no animal is going to carry like a severed arm and just drop it in your backyard or whatever. But also, they probably should have thought about building a fence before doing the body farm.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you are being a little bit selfish with your thinking as a researcher, it is kind of nice, if you're trying to get natural circumstances to study, to not install a big environment-impacting fence around
your
property.
Because that would inhibit the movement of animals who might come in and, like, nibble.
Yeah, you're going to affect some migration patterns of animals and probably some of the plant life and whatnot. So, I understand. But yeah, you're right. Like, there needs to be a little bit of a mutual understanding and respect here if you're going to put a body farm so close to a business.
Yeah, or like just someone's backyard. Like just waking up in the morning and getting a cup of coffee and looking out your back window and being like,
that's a fucking body.
Yeah. It's very silly, but a lot of these concerns end up getting kind of brushed aside once body farms are able to be like, listen, there have been a lot of murders and disappearances that have been solved by using our services. Usually people acquiesce, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I really like that at one point they were just like, you just need to build a fence. That's really gross.
I can just imagine some researchers just like infuriated, like, people don't understand the level of work we're doing here. They don't respect me and what I'm trying to accomplish. Someone's like, just build a fence.
Just build a fence.
I just don't want to see that shit. It's fucking gross.
It's like this person's got kids.
Yeah. And they're like, oh, okay, yeah, that's understandable. We can just talk to each other.
Yeah.
You know?
Talk across across the body farm aisle, I guess.
Yes.
So that is all I had, unless you had any other thoughts.
Not really. I just think that this is really cool. This is just kind of the intersection of so many things that I think are interesting about the sort of things we talk about, where we're talking about something sustainable and responsible to do with dead bodies. We're talking about something that is actually making the world a better place.
Yep.
You know, these body farms exist basically to bring closure and justice to the families and friends of murder victims and people who have died of awful things. And it helps us understand a lot of the problems in the world when we, you know, set up these facilities to explore really gruesome, nasty things.
Yeah.
And I try to remind myself of that because, again, the horror crime nerd in me just wants to, like, see all the gruesome stuff.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we gotta hold that in check. We gotta hold that in tension a little bit, those of us who are, you know, a little bit gore hound. Like, no, that's, you know, I don't need to visit this place to respect it and really love that this is the kind of work that's going on.
You just go, oh, this is like a hard science.
Yeah, that absolutely.
These people are engaged in.
Yes. So yeah, I guess to close, I do want to make a couple recommendations. One, again, Death's Acre by William Bass. I believe that is the Knoxville facility.
Yes.
The University of Tennessee. Yep. Fascinating dude. Fascinating story of how that facility opened up and everything that happened. Just can't recommend that book enough. It's a lot of fun to read. Also, a couple of years ago, the podcast Criminal actually went to the Texas body farm.
Oh, no way.
So it was one of very rare tours given to Phoebe Judge. You know,
yeah.
Like, it's an amazing podcast. It's like a really, if you like the idea of true crime, but you want to get away from like the sensational kind of like exploitative part of it, and you're interested in the stories, can't recommend Criminal enough. It's a great podcast.
But it's like Dateline, but fun.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Also, Phoebe Judge has like this lovely voice that makes me calm, and it's like, her voice is ASMR. It's fantastic. But yeah, definitely recommend checking those out if you want to nerd out over body farms the way that we have.
What's the name of the episode?
All the Time in the World. It was released June 2nd, 2017, episode 68 of Criminal. You can find that at thisiscriminal.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. But enough about their podcast. We want to thank you for listening to ours. Tell us what you think. What do you think of body farms? Are they cool? Are they nasty? Do you hate bugs? You hate flesh-eating bugs?
Would you give your body to one?
Would you donate your body to one? Do you live near one?
Do you like the idea of being eaten by a squirrel?
Would you rather be eaten by a squirrel or a rat? Tell us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PreDeadBoys. You can email us predeadboys@gmail.com. Search Pre-Dead Boys Podcast on Facebook to join our Facebook group. Or join our very active Discord, which shout out to all the new people who jumped in. We've got a lot of very creative and intelligent people in there.
Yeah.
And if I can be at the risk of being a little mushy, but you know, it's Valentine's Day, 'tis the season. big smooches to everyone in our Discord group. I just feel like a lot of people I know who are making podcasts or doing creative things, they get real lost in like trying to make it a lucrative, successful thing and trying to get a shit ton of followers and a shit ton of people into it. And I feel like we have had this awesome, like very small, tight-knit community of people who are really interested in just talking to each other and actually forming friendships.
Yeah.
That's the coolest shit ever. Like,
yeah, people like posting rabbits and like dope studded jackets.
Yeah. Yeah. It blows my mind. Like, if we never turn this podcast into something that's like lucrative for me and Max financially, I won't care. Like, the more of that that we can have of you guys actually like talking to each other and engaging with each other and with us, we love that.
Absolutely.
That's what makes this podcast really satisfying. I know for me, and I think for you too, Max, of like people all around the world are connecting with each other through just this little thing that we're throwing together.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, this is shit that we would be talking about and nerding out about regardless if there was a microphone in front of us. So
absolutely.
We appreciate you guys joining us for that.
It's the $8,000 a month I make is like nice, but I mean, it's not
$8,000 a month? Off of the podcast?
No, I didn't say that.
How are you making that?
What?
You got an OnlyFans page that I don't know
what
about?
I didn't. What are you talking? What are you talking? I'm sorry.
8,000? That was recorded.
Did we do a podcast?
It was a live.
Is
mic.
This? Hold on. I gotta. Hold on.
Hello? Yeah, I can talk. What's up? Yeah. No. What's up? Hey. Yeah. I can talk.
All right. Max is gone. While he's taking that fake ass phone call, I'll just tell y'all about our Patreon. If you have not seen our Patreon page and you would like to support what we do on the podcast, go to patreon.com/predeadboys. You can pitch in $1, $5 a month, and if you do that, you get little behind the scenes tidbits on our secret Patreon blog only for subscribers. It's a special little Valentine's Day treat. It will be out by the time you're listening to this, but I make little digital wallpapers for mobile and desktop devices for the people who subscribe at $5 a month. And at the suggestion of Oriana, one of our listeners, I turned one of them into like a little printable Valentine's Day card.
Yeah, that's very sweet.
That you can get on there. Again, if you support us at the $5 a month level or more, you can go download that card and just print it off your computer. And I recommend printing it on like some kind of fancy resume paper that's a light color. And you fold that in half and write a little personal, you know, romantic note to bae. Do people still say bae?
Before anyone else. Hell yeah.
Yeah. There you go. But you're listening to this after Valentine's Day, so I guess just, you know, hope you did something cool for Valentine's Day.
Hope you remembered.
But yeah, make sure you check out our Patreon if you haven't. Also, if we get up to $100 a month total of donations, we're going to start doing bonus episodes just for our patrons. Make sure you do that. Yeah, I'm dying to do this episode. I've been like, I've got a tab open.
You've got a tab.
Yeah, I've been doing research for our first, I guess, morbid topic that we would cover on a bonus episode. So please support us so that we can afford to do that. Shout out to our new patrons. Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Saw you jumping in the Discord too. It's been lovely getting to know y'all. And Sarah Richard, who is an amazing artist.
Very cool. Chance,
you
very
should go
cool
to
stuff.
SarahRichardArt.com and check out her work. A lot of really beautiful, I think, watercolor or gouache paintings of wildlife and cool stuff. And also she does a lot of comics work with My Little Pony and a few other big franchises. And I was impressed. I was like, why are you talking to us?
Yeah, I'm scum.
We really appreciate you guys supporting us. Y'all are great. If you want to support this podcast and you don't have money to donate to a Patreon, don't sweat it. Just tell friends about this podcast. We spread completely word of mouth. We don't do any advertising or anything. So just recommend your favorite episode to a bud to listen to. And we will be forever grateful for that. Our intro and outro music is the song About Time by Brat Curse. Check them out at bratcurse.bandcamp.com. You can listen to them on Spotify or wherever you stream music. And that's going to do it for us. You know what I was thinking is, we've got Body Farms, right? They're doing really incredible research. And we don't want people just traveling in there, taking tours, poking things.
True.
But I was thinking, I've got a business idea. All right. This is how we're actually going to make $8,000.
I love capitalism.
Okay. Yeah, me too. You know Kosai, right? How it's like an interactive museum.
Yes.
Right? There's lots of things you can play with. And
yes.
You thinking what I'm thinking? That's
what
right.
What are you thinking? Be explicit.
Interactive body farm museum. You can play with the bodies. You can take pictures with them.
Aww.
You can buy fragments of bodies in the gift shop.
You can buy really expensive food at like our little cafe we'll have.
Guess where it's the like... food comes from. Max and Jordan here, reminding you, you're gonna rock. And you might as well donate your body to a body farm and rot there.
It's true.
Bye. Damn, dog, it's 4:30.
Yeah.
We should probably record a podcast. We can save our Zelda content for our spin-off Zelda podcast. When we start our podcast network.
Zellacast.